Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Maggie Anderson. Maggie Anderson is the author of four books of poetry, including Windfall, New and Selected Poems, A Space Filled with Moving, and Cold Comfort. She has edited several thematic anthologies, including A Gathering of Poets, a collection of poems read at the 20th anniversary commemoration of the shootings at Kent State University in 1970, as well as Learning by Heart, Contemporary American Poetry About School, and After the Bell, Contemporary American Prose About School. Her awards include two fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, fellowships from the Ohio, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania Councils on the Arts, and the Ohiana Library Award for contributions to the literary arts in Ohio. The founding director of the Wick Poetry Center and of the Wick Poetry Series of the Kent State University Press, Anderson is professor emerita of English at Kent State University and lives in Asheville, North Carolina. Her new collection of poems, entitled Dear All, is forthcoming from Four Way Books. Hi, Maggie. How are you?
Good. How are you, Jan?
I'm good. I'm so happy that you're here in Pittsburgh, which is one of your psychic homes.
Yes.
And you're going to start with poems from Cold Comfort, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
I want to read one from Cold Comfort, which is called As Close. I could stay awake for years driving the nighttime streets of this West Virginia city in a rusted VW that doesn't belong to me. I am alive in October, ready to record the rise in the wind. It's because of the leaves, how they shine from the inside with that bright light, how they shift their colors from hour to hour, how they traipse around the bends of the Kanawha like scrip pulsing down to the coal towns. I don't want anyone I've ever loved to leave me now. I want all my friends and old lovers and the children I know to stand beside me and push their heels with mine down into the damp ground if it rains. I want us all to stand together in our red boots in the early morning fog, watching the wet webs on the weeds and connecting our strong eyes to their fragility. If we begin to cry, I want us to know it's because of the way our shirt sleeves brush against our own arms and each other's, as close as the coming snow will be to the stark trees and the black branches it will pack up into. I spent some time in the 1980s living in Pittsburgh, and I spent other periods of time living in Ohio and Oregon and West Virginia and various other places. I'd like to read a poem now that has some of those locations in it, Pittsburgh, Ohio, Oregon. It's called A Few Small Gestures of Concern. Just north of Hartville, Ohio, where I drove today, thick woods opened out into fields and cattle pastured down to the lake. My mind was full of lists of meetings, picking up medication and dry cleaning, when suddenly, for no reason, I was remembering the time Lynn bought my lunch, when I had money enough to pay for my own. But because she didn't know what to say to my grief, she said, I want to buy your lunch. And it was expensive and good, and I was grateful, which made me think of Sandra, whom I haven't seen in years, walking beside the Willamette in Portland in the cold sleet of a November night. Nothing happened. We walked two city blocks, talking pleasantly about nothing in particular. Then she asked me if I wanted to borrow her gloves. One afternoon 30 years ago or more, in my makeshift office in the Cathedral of Learning, with no furniture but a view of the Heinz Chapel spire, dark with rain and city grime, Ed stuck his head in the door and said, "It's a little alienating, isn't it?" I wasn't sure if he meant Pittsburgh or teaching, the view or life in general, but they all were. And who would have thought I would remember this so clearly for all these years? In December 1971, I was visiting Jane Bennett in California, Pennsylvania, where I called my father from a wooden phone booth in a drugstore. He was 3 days away from his death, alone in his apartment, aphasic from the strokes. I told him, "I love you," and he said, "You're right." Those were his last words to me. Sometimes when the years come close like this, everything that happened once seems to have been happening forever. Someone is putting cold cloths on my head because it hurts. Someone is sitting on the edge of my bed, where I am a fevered child in another world far beyond hearing. Today I was only busy, but when Anna touched my shoulder and told me, "Take a little nap, you're exhausted," I could see I was. So I lay down heavily, like the bales of hay the good farmer of Hartville pitched out for his stock, because the ground is frozen solid, because the weeds are iced with hoarfrost. And like the cattle, I ambled over the cold field to take whatever might be offered now from the flat bed of the mostly reliable wagon. This is a poem that was written some time ago when I was a poet in residence in West Virginia in the Poets in the Schools program, and I worked in a lot of small towns, one and two room schoolhouses up in the mountains. And one of the things that struck me when I was working there was how many of the young high school age students were not in school, but were out in the street during the afternoon smoking cigarettes on the corner, or they had dropped out because they got pregnant. And there was a very, very high dropout rate. And I wanted to talk a little bit in a poem about what happens when you have a lot of young people who are not otherwise occupied. One of the things that happens is their free bodies to go to war. Spitting in the leaves. In Spanishburg, there are boys in tight jeans, mud on their cowboy boots, and they wear huge hats with feathers. Skunk feathers, they tell me. They do not want to be in school, but are. Some teacher cared enough to hold them. Unlike their thin, disheveled cousins, the boys on Matoka's Main Street in October who loll against parking meters and spit into the leaves. Because of them, someone will think we need a war, will think the best solution would be for them to take their hats and feathers, their good country manners, and drag them off somewhere, to Vietnam, to El Salvador, and they'll go. They'll go from West Virginia, from hills and back roads that twist like politics through trees, and they'll fight, not because they know what for, but because what they know is how to fight. What they know is feathers, their strong, skinny arms, their spitting in the leaves.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Maggie Anderson, reading her work. Now, I love that poem, Spitting in the Leaves, and I've heard it a number of times, but every time I hear it, it gets me. I get chills every time that you read it. You know, it seems to me like that's the best the poetry can do is move us every time, move us differently. And I wonder if you could talk about that poem. And I know you said that that was one of the few poems that came quickly to you.
Yeah, it did. And, you know, this is a strange thing to say, but I get chills when I read this poem, partly because of sort of an obvious thing. The boys are still there. They are still going to war. We are having an endless war. The names of the wars in here, Vietnam, El Salvador, are not our current wars, but it doesn't really matter. What matters, I guess, to me is the human beings, the human lives, that when the coal fields are unemployed, when people drop out of school, it becomes an automatic source of, pardon the expression, I guess, cannon fodder. And because West Virginia, as a state and as a place, has always had the highest number of people dying in all of the wars of the last century and this century, because of a tremendous patriotism that is in those mountains, that they will fight. That's what they know. That's what they will do. When I read this poem, I guess I feel that history as well as those young men I saw in that particular place at that time.
Yeah, it's really powerful. I guess I wanted to ask you, I mean, you've worked in very many places. You've been writing for so many years and have so many wonderful poems. So I want to ask you, as you, as Maggie Anderson, how do you know what makes a poem? When you come upon something, how do you know now what makes a poem? And has that changed from when you were 20 years old and in graduate school, or, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure it has. Age brings something, hopefully some wisdom. But I love that young poet. One of the things I think about publishing poetry is that it's a kind of agreement to do your growing in public. And so when you look at a poet's early work, you see a certain kind of person and probably of a certain age. And when you see the poetry of a 90-year-old, you're seeing something completely different. One of the things I know about poetry, and I will quote my mentor and friend, the late Gwendolyn Brooks, who said that a poem comes when you are importantly excited about an idea or a surmise or an emotion. And she italicized importantly, because emotions go through us every day, for example, but only some of them are important. And for me, that is still, was in the beginning, is still where the poems come from being excited about an emotion, for wondering about something like, what if this or what if that? And some poems, I think, come from ideas, from reading, from newspaper articles, from information about the natural world. And those were my earliest sources for poetry, and they remain my sources today.
Okay. Could you read some more poems?
Sure. One of the things I think about sometimes in writing poems, not always, is the form the poem is taking, how the lines look on the page, whether there are internal rhymes or end rhymes, what's going on with the sound of the poem. And I realized, sort of in retrospect, that I had written a number of sonnets, or approximate sonnets, I will say, because certain things are not exactly like Shakespeare. But I think what I like about the sonnet form is it's short, it has sections, and there's a surprise at the end. There's a turn that the sonnet takes in the last quatrain that sort of goes in another direction. So I'd like to read one of those sonnets, if that's okay. And yeah. This one in particular was written some time ago. It's not a current poem. It's called The Only Angel. And it was during a time when angels were very popular. People were buying angel statues and wearing angel buttons on their clothes. And being the sort of contrarian that I am, I thought, angels. What about angels? Well, there's only really one angel, and that's the angel of death, and we're all going to have to wrestle that one. That's just how it is. So I thought, I'm going to write about the only angel, and the sonnet form struck me as appropriate for an angel, right? I can see that what with one thing and another, you're all worn down, but you have to quit calling out to me with all these elegies. You're sweet, but it's clear you don't know anything. I could bring you to your knees with one hard kiss, but I want you to mother up the good life. Get around a little more. You're trying too hard, hedging your bets. I am not a porcelain light behind the trees. You can't touch me. I'm not even here yet. Your heart attack, your wreck, your slow disease. I am what you cannot know, the blank, imposing door that you will storm one day to get at me, hot and ready, since you will have to be. Since that's a relatively early poem, I'll read a later poem. I'd like to read actually the title poem from my new book, Dear All. I'm enough of an English teacher that I keep telling people the title of my book is Dear All, comma. So this poem begins, Dear All, comma. Before I read it, I want to say to your question about writing differently when you're younger, this is a poem I know I could not have written until I was the age I am now.
Okay.
You, whose memory comes to me, winter afternoons as the soon-gone sun falls low and thin. You whom I knew long and well. You who have come to hate me now. You I knew but slightly, knew not well but cared to, had there been place enough and time. You who are the trees out the window to me, the shallow-rooted I have always loved. I greet you in my unsent letters, in both my random and my steady thoughts. You whom I failed to thank, and you I failed to turn to. You I have tried and tried to speak to and have not been able to cross those seas. You I fought with in the snow, in unsatisfactory shoes, marching up and down, shouting at each other, so hot we were, so cold, the drifts deepening. You I let down, and you I picked up by the highway. You who have made a name for yourself. You who were called away and never came back, and you who would not leave. You I worked with as we had never worked before, side by side in the studio with five windows glazed by yellow light. You I no longer know, but fear dead. Drugs, car wrecks, the several wars, the usual deaths of my generation. And you who have gone the distance, beyond your disappointments, beyond your cancers and their dire cures. My friends, I send you this letter from the landscape of our days together. You must not wonder if I think of you still. I have remembered you wholly into this day.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Maggie Anderson, reading some of her new poems and some of older poems and all kinds of poems. But I love that poem that you just read, and that idea of... You couldn't have written this poem years ago. I think we've all read books by poets whose work seems to be their first book seems to be their best, and and that's I don't know what you can say about that except that huge push to write that first book. But your books seem just to be getting deeper and deeper and sort of broader and wider. I don't know. I know that you have, the poem you just read has such breadth, and I'm not sure what my question is, except that I know that you took a while to write this book, which I want to repeat, is called Dear All, comma, and is going to be published by Four Way Books, so we'll be excited to read that. But can you talk about the long, slow process of writing and why it takes that? Because I believe in slow writing also, and some people will churn out a book every 2 years, and I don't think that's possible.
I don't either. I mean, clearly it's possible because a lot of people do it. I'm not sure it's advisable, and I'm not sure that those books are always of equal quality. I am a slow writer, though, and I always knew that, but I started early. I wrote the first poems I ever wrote. I was in the second grade, and I was very, very fortunate. I lived in New York, and we had a poet who came to the school and asked us to go outside and look around and write poems about what we saw. And I wrote a poem about how the bark of a dog was like the bark of a tree. Very clever, I thought. And the teacher liked it, and I continued to write. I think that for me, the long time it has taken to write this new book, Dear All, and it was a long time, close to 20 years, was a time period when I was very busy, as many writers are, doing things to earn a living, to have a family, to raise some children, to do all the things that occupy our lives other than our art. And I was surprised to discover when I retired that I had actually almost written a book during that time. And I was actually looking at the poems and saying, where did that come from? It was such a surprise. And then after that, after I retired, it was sort of a matter of collating the poems I already had written and didn't know I had written, but it was also a matter of taking a year or two to see where I am now. And I think that's what poetry is. It's not so much starting with something that you have in your head. It's more like things are happening to you, aging, fun things, sex, trips to the beach, hard labor. And among all those things, if you are an artist, if you are a poet, the poems will come. Mm-hmm. Sometimes fast, sometimes slow.
Mm-hmm. This is a little bit of a leap, but I wanted to ask you about, you have a number of poems about war, and can you talk about the courage it takes to write those poems, and if there are moments when you stop yourself and say, can I do this, and then what enables you to keep going writing poems that are very political and may not be received well by some people?
That's an interesting question, and I think it raises an issue about what we think poetry in particular, the arts in general, what poetry in particular can do, has a right to do. Where did poetry, I mean, in the face of war, I sit at a desk and put words on paper. On the other hand, I feel very, very strongly about war and about the violence that is in most people's daily lives these days. And so I guess I think part of my job is to try to write about what affects me most deeply, what I'm importantly thinking about. And as I listen to the radio, as I read newspapers, as I watch television, everywhere there is war, there is violence. War struck me very early because I lost five of my classmates from high school in West Virginia in the Vietnam War. Since then, I have known many people who came back from that war and from other wars damaged. And I guess that's why I figure, okay, somebody's not going to like it. I'm a woman. I haven't been in war. But I know a thing or two about what it's like to live under war.
Okay. Yeah, could you read?
Yeah, there's a poem, a recent poem, called Reading Yusuf. Yusuf Komunyakaa is a wonderful poet and a friend of mine, and he was a soldier during the Vietnam War and has written much about that. Reading Yusuf. I'm up early reading your poems again and picturing that war. The way I woke in those days on the hard bunk in my dorm room wondering who was killed today, who came back, how broken. Everything I was burning to know but was afraid to hear about. Once we sat together in the apartment with the spiral staircase, descending to the dark room of everything where you wrote and read and slept. And yes, there was a saxophone somewhere, alive with wine and flash and gunfire, Coltrane above us, or someone just a little bit like Coltrane, just a little bit. And we were facing each other in the room where we could not turn around. Your hands were full of books and papers. Mine were insistently, deliberately not moving at my sides. So much I wanted to know if you could tell me, but I had to leave. Something else to do, It was afternoon then, and me going off into it to meet that tall white boy who was plenty mad at me since I was already late and lost and half asleep with long remembering. It was as if I could still hear the dinosaurs crossing the once fertile valley of the desert, snuffling and grunting like giant javelinas, or the first low notes of a trombone breaking in through the oldest silence. I know how sometimes we stand between oneself and another, how we can become each other's shadows. I have listened hard for you, like trying to follow a whisper in the wind. Now, beneath the constant rant and roar, I hear you still when I'm reading about war, as I was again this morning in your poems.
That's a beautiful poem. I think we have time for another poem.
Another poem?
Mm-hmm.
More poems. This is very exciting. I think I'd like to read a poem that's a little bit silly.
Okay.
It's not silly. Actually, it's a very serious poem. But it may sound silly. Anything is good material for poetry. Anything. And this is a poem called In Real Life, which is sort of based on not really even a dream. I don't want to tell you what it is. I'll surprise you. But okay. It does begin with a quote from Oscar Wilde, who said, "One's real life is often the life that one does not lead." I've been napping in my chair and have wakened just in time. Sleeping in the daytime sharpens me for nightlife, as if it were my job to get up and wet down my reeds to play the clarinet in a small ensemble where the first set doesn't start till 10:30. My nap was the color of a moss agate, gray-green and striped, buffed to sheen and sweat. The usual nightmares. The house burns down with all my writing in it. A famous and successful writer friend offers me her dregs. "Here, take these. I don't need them anymore." My editor ransacks my closet. His shirt is ripped off by my faithful and beautiful half-vicious dog. In real life, I am planning a new career. I imagine for myself a small congregation of gay Episcopalians somewhere in the Midwest, in a town not known for tolerance, but respectful, even a bit in awe of anything that passes for style. I am their priest, their good shepherd, and all my flock play musical instruments and give amusing dinner parties. Or there is the life I seem to have imagined myself into, in which I'm cleaning my reeds and shining my shoes for the band that doesn't exist in the town I never lived in, playing the instrument I don't know how to play.
The poetry of Maggie Anderson. Thank you so much. That was great.
Thanks, Jan.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.